to the Bites and Bites podcast. I'm your host, Kristen DeMoranville. Today, I'm joined by Scott Algier, the executive director of the IT ISAC and the Food and Ag ISAC. This position places him at the forefront of the efforts to secure critical infrastructure against emerging cyber threat. With an educational background in international relations, Scott has spent the past 20 years at the intersection of cybersecurity policy and operations. Through collaborative efforts, he brings a unique perspective to our discussion on safeguarding our food supply in the digital age. So let's get started, and I hope you enjoy my conversation with Scott.
Hi, Scott. Thanks for being on the podcast today. I really appreciate your time. I know that you were very busy, and it's really great that you took the time out to talk to everybody about what you've been working on. I will let you introduce yourself, and then we'll jump into the fun bits.
Yeah, Kristen, thanks for having me. It's great to be here. Appreciate the invitation. I'm Scott Algier. I'm the executive director of the Food and Agriculture Information Sharing and Analysis Center, the Food and Ag ISAC.
Scott, do you want to give people a little bit of a background of why founded? And then how you kind of got mixed up in all that.
Yeah, of course. I appreciate the question. The Food and Ag ISAC was established in May of 2023 as part of a partnership with the Information Technology ISAC. I also am the executive director of the Information Technology ISAC, and the IT ISAC had been accepting memberships from food and agriculture companies since about 2008 or 2009, because the food and ag industry didn't have its own sector-specific ISAC. So there was no home for those type of companies. We started getting applications because food and ag companies leverage corporate IT in meaningful ways, and the board of directors of the IT ISAC at the time made some sense, right? It was part of the common good to help these companies out. Over the years, we started accumulating more companies as members, and around 2013, we established what we call the special interest group within the IT ISAC. So the concept was you provide a forum for food and agriculture companies to talk about some of the unique security challenges that they have and some of the unique threats that they're seeing. By 2023, the decision from our member companies was that it made sense to form an ISAC. There were a lot of discussions going on prior to 2023 within our membership about forming an ISAC for the food and agriculture industry, but there are also some challenges and that we wanted to overcome before we launched. And by May of 2023, things just kind of came together. We developed a model that we thought would work, which I'd be happy to talk about more. There was some interest within policymakers about the food and agriculture industry not having a sector-specific ISAC. There was more articles written in the media about the lack of an ISAC, and the internal planning we had within the Food and Agriculture Special Interest Group, the need that we were seeing from the industry as we were talking to industry and from policymakers as we're engaging with them, it made the timing was perfect because we were ready at the right at the same time some of these policy discussions were started to take shape.
Yeah, that couldn't have been more timely, honestly, right? Because that all just kind of worked and fell down perfectly. Thanks for that, Scott. I really appreciate it. Let's jump into my favorite moment with guests, of course, is can you tell me what your favorite food and your favorite food memory is? And it doesn't have to be the same thing.
Okay, well, that's great because they're not the same thing. My favorite food is lomo saltado. It's a Peruvian dish. My wife is from Peru. She makes the second best lomo saltado I've ever had, and she's okay with me saying that. But it's a mix of beef, rice, fries, and some special sauce that they have. It's just delicious. The best one was from a restaurant in D.C. that actually closed. So although my wife's now the second best I've ever had, it's the best I consume on a regular basis now. So it's awesome. It's a really good dish. A former employer is the one who introduced it to me prior to me knowing my wife. So that's another little coincidence there. And my favorite food memory. From seventh grade through college, I would go down and visit my grandfather in Florida, and we do spring training games. And my favorite food memory is sitting at the ballpark with him in March, eating hot dogs and pretzels and drinking a soda.
Baseball park memories are right up there for me too. Yeah. There's nothing that beats Fenway Frank at Fenway Park for me. And, you know, cold beer or you know, something to that effect, a pretzel, of course. So I completely say that. And I also say this knowing that Scott has all these pictures of baseball behind him, and one of them happens to be Babe Ruth. So, and now he knows that I'm a Red Sox fan.
Well, that's, I don't know if this is helping the cause any, but I'm actually a Mets fan. The main thing is, they're gifts, they're meaningful gifts to me, so I have them up. They're in other parts of my office, there's Mets stuff.
It's all right. I don't have any problems with the Mets. I did date a Mets fan in college, so, and he risked his life by wearing a Mets jersey into the bleachers of Fenway. Huh. There was people chanting very bad things at him.
Yes.
Rather amusing, actually, than I think about it. And I warned him, but he didn't listen. You don't mess with Boston fans.
Not right, but now he has an experience to talk about.
Yeah, that's very true, and I'm sure he did. Anyways, that's great. I love that. I actually never experienced spring training, but everybody I've ever known that's gone and said it was just a really awesome time in Florida, so that's great. I'm really glad you had that memory with your grandfather.
Appreciate that. Awesome. Thank you, yeah.
Yeah, that's great. Thanks for that, too, and that's the most interesting dish that anybody said as their favorite food. Most people are like, you know, pizza or tacos, which is totally great. That's great too. You are one you're the most specific one I've ever had.
Oh,
and that sounds really good because I was going to ask where that DC restaurant was, but when you said it closed, I was like, oh.
We actually went looking for it a couple of weeks ago. We looked it up, how to get there, and it's permanently closed. And oh no, and I checked the website. Yeah. So it's unfortunate, but there's still plenty of Peruvian restaurants that serve it.
Oh yeah.
And I'm happy that my wife she makes it better than anyone I know.
Well, next time I'm in a Peruvian restaurant, which is actually fairly frequent for me, I will make sure that I will try that because I don't know why I never have. Maybe it was the fries. I mean, because I have a British fiance, I do eat a lot of chip fries.
Yeah, right.
I don't tend to order them when I go out because I really like his fries. You can't beat triple cooked fries. What? Sorry, just can't. Like, that's a hard one for me. Like, can we talk about what the benefits are for the food and ag chapter, just in general? And I have a mixed audience, Scott, so I should be really clear. I do have food, I do have cybersecurity, I have IT that listens, and I also have a few other people on the peripheral that are in supply chain that listen as well. You can curb your answer as you need to.
Well, the Food and Agriculture ISAC, the Food and Ag ISAC, was formed in partnership with the IT ISAC, as we discussed.
Yep.
And the general concept of an information sharing and analysis center is to provide industry a way to share intelligence with each other, threat intelligence, so that those companies can better secure themselves and also serve as a resource to their peer companies. So it serves as a pretty cost-effective force multiplier. Companies don't have enough money to hire all of the analysts they need. Companies undertaking projects other companies have already accomplished or already failed at. Provides a great opportunity for the analysts from these companies to talk to each other about the threats and the challenges that they're seeing. We leverage near real-time threat sharing through the indicators of compromise through an intelligence management platform. We have adversary attack playbooks on over 300 actors that are targeting various industries. We have a ransomware tracker. Our members contribute to this. So I have an analytic team. They develop the initial product. So for example, usually adversary attack playbooks. They'll develop a playbook based on the wider framework for a specific actor, put it in our platform, make it available to members. And when a member company sees that actor on their network, they can go in and suggest an update to the playbook. And our team gets notified about it. They'll see the updates that are being made, and they have the opportunity to contact the analyst who's making the update and talk to them about it and accept it or reject it. So it's really a collaborative effort to provide actionable threat intelligence to member companies. There's daily reports that go out. There's incident-specific reports that go out to the members. And it's the Food and Ag ISAC is really a unique environment because we're establishing a farm-to-table information sharing and analysis center. And it's global as well. Our member companies operate globally, right? So even if you're headquartered in someplace in the Midwest, a lot of these companies have operations around the world. So it's a global sector. It's a global supply chain. And we're building the ISAC to reflect that.
I love that it's member driven. So how it goes and what is discussed and what changes are made and editing and or whatever comes from the members. It's not just some like power on high necessarily that's dictating what's going to happen. And that's so essential, and especially in cybersecurity or security incidents in general, is we don't talk enough. We don't share enough information to make better decisions. We need more data, is what we always say. And I love that this is happening, especially for food and ag, because they need it. They need support. And they talk really well amongst themselves, generally. The food professionals are very chatty. I mean, you experienced that, Scott, when we were at the consortium this year.
Yes.
Very chatty, very like friends, you know, neighborly vibes. And it's nice to see that this is channeling that, because that's going to resonate really heavily. And I like it that it's a global audience as well, because the food supply chain is global. Regardless if you're just serving one country or not, it's still affecting others because of, you know, different ingredients coming in from all over the place. We don't inherently grow everything and we don't have everything. So it's good to see that the community is coming together in that regard. That's wonderful.
Plus what we produce goes globally as well. Right. Mm-hmm. So it's really, there's a unique set of challenges within the food and agriculture industry that they're not common in other industries. So I remember when we really discussed when we first brought on the started accepting food and agriculture companies, there was, yeah, they have the same corporate IT, let's take them on, right? And then we started to form the SIG and we're like, whoa, these companies are, this supply chain that they're operating is really interconnected. There's some really large global companies, but then there are some very small mom and pop shop type companies that are connected to these larger suppliers. The countries where they operate in, they don't really, you don't get to choose what crop grows where, right? I mean, that's...
Yeah.
So it's really a complex environment. And our member companies, we were focused a lot on cybersecurity, as you might expect, but there's a lot of issues beyond cybersecurity that our members are talking about.
Sure. It's interesting too, because I've been having a lot of conversations with guests about what are we going to do about our labor force for agriculture? And it's hard to hire, hard to bring them in. And the overarching kind of feeling is that, you know, AI is kind of come in and help out these companies and provide a tool so they won't hire so many people. You just made me think this is a great tool for these companies to use, this data sharing, so they can make better informed decisions, but not necessarily hiring an entire security operations center or, you know, having to hire various other people. They can get that information, make the determination if they're going to bring in an MSP or not.
Yeah, I think that's really a good point. There's a misperception that the only the largest companies can benefit from participating in an ISAC. Your average company isn't going to do automated indicator sharing, right? So that's correct. For these larger companies, help inform the smaller companies who generally want to know, what do I need to do, right?
Yeah.
They're not
yeah.
interested in necessarily APT9. They're interested in, how do I defend my network, right?
Yep.
Against the attacks that are occurring today. I think most end users or most small businesses understand the complex environments. They may not all know all of the APT actors and all of the intricacies, but they understand that cybersecurity is a threat environment that they need to be aware of. It's changing. They don't have the resources or the expertise to understand what threat this week they need to pay attention to keep up. So these larger enterprises help provide actionable information to these smaller companies by telling them, this is what you need to do. And on our use our playbooks as an example, you don't need to have to ingest the whole playbook, but there's a section there that tells you how they get in and how to block them. So you can go there, right? And this playbook is built by some of the largest companies, and you as a small, medium-sized enterprise now have access to the same analysis and the same techniques to stop these attacks that the larger enterprises do.
I like it how it's practical advice, and it's not just like fluffy, you know, basic advice, like have strong passwords, which we all know. And I like it that you have actionable, practical things that are being shared. That's brilliant. I like that the larger companies are giving back to the smaller companies in a way. I think that's how we win in a way.
Right.
Because I think the collaboration between the various different towers and functions is only way we're going to keep the food supply chain safe anyways. Can you tell me with all this information sharing that you get within the membership, and the benefits behind it. Do you also get, you have special guests that come in and talk? Do you have anybody from, like, I don't know, Department of Homeland Security or any of the US entities or any beyond that will come in and special and highlight?
Yes, the answer is yes. We have guest speakers come in both for the food and agriculture ISAC, but also for the IT ISAC. And this is a kind of an important point to kind of foot stop on. The members of the food and agriculture ISAC are also members of the IT ISAC. So it's part of the partnership that we have. The companies and the food and ag ISAC, they get two ISACs for the price of one. And yeah, what's really important about this is that the IT ISAC has some of the world's leading technology and security companies who are our members, but we also bring in outside experts who are guest speakers. You get food and agriculture ISAC members, they tap into that knowledge from day one, right? They have access to that. These adversary attack playbooks I mentioned, they're being updated by food and ag ISAC member companies, but also IT ISAC member companies. So you get this knowledge share from beyond the food and agriculture industry, including the IT IT industry, which propels modern agriculture, right? It's underpinned so much of modern agriculture. So the relationship between IT and the fruit and ag is really important. And that's one of the, when I talked in the beginning about developing a model, that was one of the sticky wickets we were trying to work through, is when you establish a new ISAC, who wants to start over, right? You start from scratch and have no capabilities. The IT ISAC's been around for over 20 years, been built out these capabilities, has a team in place by the fruit and ag ISAC member companies, then as SIG companies, the SIG member companies, new, trusted. So we didn't want to start an ISAC and start from scratch with things take 5 years to build something. So that partnership between the IT and the fruit and agriculture industries has really demonstrated itself in the formation of the Fruit and Agriculture ISAC.
That's so great. That's such a benefit to be able to combine those two memberships for the members in general. That's, wow, I didn't realize that happened. Maybe I just wasn't paying attention, but that's fantastic. How does the information sharing go between the groups? Is it secured forums? Is it phone calls? How does that work?
All of the above. So the Fruit and Ag ISAC member companies meet every other week. Our team, when there's no outside speaker, no guest speaker, or even our member companies have the opportunity to say, hey, we're doing something neat, we want to be on the agenda, or they'll say, we're seeing something interesting that we want to talk about this week, should we have some time? So if there's no presentation from a third party, our team has a list of 3 or 5 things that are ongoing that we want to talk to the member companies about. After that, after each item, there's generally the discussion within the member companies about how that's impacting them. And then there's a opportunity at the end of the call for member companies to talk, bring up any topic that they want that they're talking about. Sometimes this leads to work streams or runoff groups. Like one example was a ransomware tracker that started with a request from a fruit and ag company to say, hey, can we track who's being hit in the fruit and ag sector by ransomware? So when 2020 we started that, said, yes, sure, we can do that. And now we're tracking across each of the, all of the critical infrastructure sectors, and seeing where fruit and ag compares. And this gives us a kind of a baseline for the industry, which is important for them. So I talked about these playbooks that we have. That was something that was member driven, right? The resource allocation issue. We can't all be monitoring the same actors all the time. So can we kind of divide and conquer, right? So let's share the knowledge that we have, build out these playbooks, and then, you know, these actors are hitting me, I will update my playbook. Or these actors are hitting you, you will update that playbook. So a lot of these decisions about how we operate are built off of these member discussions, that both the sharing of the actionable intelligence, the sharing of the indicators that they're seeing, but also understanding their needs and where some of the gaps are and how we as a community can help close those gaps and build their teams.
That's fantastic. I really like that a lot. The fact that they are sharing across and actively contributing to whatever they decide to do.
I want to express my heartfelt thanks to you, the listeners. The Bites and Bites podcast is now heard in 53 countries and consistently ranks in the top 5 technology podcasts in 2 countries, which is Chad and Fiji. In the United States, the podcast is ranked within the top 500 technology podcasts, which is incredible. With over 2,400 downloads since our launch in October 2023, it's clear that this adventure is only possible because of the unwavering support of the listeners. Some additional exciting news: the new website has officially launched, bitesandbitespodcast.com. It will be your go-to for show notes and more. Also, the new website features a donation tip jar for those asking how to support the show. Your generosity in any amount helps ensure the continuation of this podcast. Thank you for being the best part of the Bites and Bites podcast. Now back to the episode.
I was thinking while you were talking to Scott, and I know that you can't get into any of the details because they are closed forums. However, I'm just curious, this is just me being curious. Has one of the topics come up recently that they're becoming more concerned about the water that is being hacked and or, you know, ransomware?
So I'll say that we're monitoring what's going on with the water sector. Yes, it has not gone unnoticed.
Yeah, it's very concerning. I'm sure a lot of us in the industry have just done the whole, whoa, wait, what? And it's just interesting because, you know, they recently just retracted the cybersecurity guidelines for, or the creation of them government-wise for water recently, and this is happening. So it's sort of like, this is a no-brainer. We all know that it needs to get done. And I'm glad to hear that they're concerned about it enough that maybe they'll put some more pressure so we can get this moving, because we need to do something about it. Either it's regulations or, I don't know, just a set of guidelines, something, anything. We just need to get it done.
Yeah. Well, I'll say this. We do work closely. We're both from the Food and Ag ISAC side and the IT ISAC side. We work closely with our partners and other ISACs. And this includes water. There's an information sharing and analysis center for water. We know the team over there very well. We talk with them often, and we do share, you know, we share information with each other. So when you see attacks like this, I think it piques the interest of just about every critical infrastructure sector, not just because of the interdependency on water, but because
it's water.
But also, it's a lot of these attacks may start confined to an industry, but then they expand out, right? And if you're seeing, you know, some actors attacking a specific industry, hey, you could be next, right? So there's a lot of interest for various reasons around what's going on there with the water sector. But I'll say, in fairness, every critical infrastructure sector is getting hit. It's not just food and ag. It's not just water.
It's true.
If you're a critical infrastructure industry, you're getting hit. Even if you're not critical infrastructure, chances are you're getting hit. So it's a problem that crosses critical infrastructure, which is why our collaboration with the National Council of ISACs is important. Our collaboration with CISA, USDA, FDA. We just spent a couple of days with them last week. Meetings with them, which is important. We're building relationships with them, which is awesome. And then I don't want to leave out the academic community. There's a lot of great research going on in public colleges and universities. And our vision is to build a partnership among those three communities. There's the industry side, and we're working with trade associations to engage with the industry. There's the government side, which they, you know, for obvious reasons, the intelligence they have or the policy making they have. But then there's the academia, which we want to help and receive some of the more of the research and development that they do, but also inform it, right? Get the perspective in industry into some of the research, and maybe, you know, talk through with them where our priorities are. One of the understudied aspects that I think academic institutions are well positioned to do is interdependencies, both within the food and agriculture, or dependencies within the food and agriculture industry, and interdependencies across, right? So how does a failure in food and agriculture that causes a disruption have cascading impacts around others? And likewise, how does a failure in the PPS system, hypothetically speaking, or what kind of impact would that have on food and agriculture? And then kind of downstream consequences does that cause?
There's so much interdependency in general. I think a lot of us automatically just think water, you know, but then there's soil, and then there's wildlife, and then there's weather, and then, you know, there's all these things that we don't even think about because we just expect food to show up on our plate, you know, because we're consumers as well.
Right.
Great that you're thinking that far ahead, that there's research that needs to be done here.
Yeah. And then if you use water as an example, right? You need water important in the IT industry for cooling, right?
Oh, yeah, for sure.
So then, you know, the dependencies within the food and ag on IT, right? And then there's no water available, right? For on the IT side, that causes problems. So yeah, we've mapped out 2008 or 2007 in the IT industry. We did a risk assessment, the IT sector based on risk assessment. I think we started in 2007. We ended up publishing in 2009, I think. We spent a lot of time trying to understand interdependencies on IT back in that day. And now we're more than 10 years later, those interdependencies have become more complex across each of the critical infrastructure sector.
Especially since you've introduced IoT and different OT systems and connecting those to the internet. And then there's all these other tools like, I don't know, AI that have been introduced, right? Automation is great, but it's very complex in how it interconnects. And sometimes we don't even know how deep that goes necessarily. So that's great. I actually really think it's important as cybersecurity and technology, IT in general, that we actually collaborate with academia. Every time I have a professor reach out and want to comment about some help with research, I always take it. If it's a PhD candidate who needs help, I always take it, that call. Because we are only going to be as strong as this research is coming out. Because that's what they're doing. They're dedicating that time in their life to that task.
Right.
Whereas the rest of us are just kind of, you know, doing the chicken with our head cut off, running around trying to put fires out.
Welcome to your invitation to Wicked 6, the 24-hour virtual cybersecurity conference that's breaking barriers and making the cyber world a tad less cybery and a lot more fun. Wicked 6 isn't just an event, It's a 24-hour marathon happening on March 29th to 30th, 2024. It's where cybersecurity community comes together to share knowledge and empower each other across all time zones, languages, and most importantly, cyber challenges. For those knowledge seekers, a virtual conference is open to all attendees of all genders. This isn't your typical conference. We're talking about a follow a sun agenda featuring top female cybersecurity talent from across the globe. These remarkable women will share their insights and experiences in multiple languages, ensuring a rich and diverse learning environment for all. You might even get a chance to see your Bytes and Bytes podcast host giving a presentation. Gamers, it's on for you. Our open capture the flag style cyber game play is where you'll spend 24 hours in this thrilling world of cyberspace, hopping across six different gaming platforms. It's like the Olympics of cyber games, and you're in it to win it, with prizes to boot. And for fiercely competitive people, we've got the International Woman-Only Cyber Skills Team Tournament. Picture the grand finale of all finales, where the top six teams go head-to-head live. It's like the Super Bowl, with less football and more hacking. What's new this year? A career center designed to demystify the cybersecurity career landscape. It's part career fair and part networking event. It's a fantastic opportunity to learn about the different career paths and network with inspiring women who've made their mark in the field. And if you're wondering how to be part of this incredible event, it's simple. Swing by wicked6.com/register/2024 to join the fun. The entry fee is $35, but do not worry, you can always use my promo code to knock $5 off your registration. All registration information and the promo code can be found in the show notes. Wicked 6 is back for its fourth year, and it's packed with speaker sessions, cyber challenges, and a tournament that will have you on your edge of your seat. It's not just an event, it's a community. It's a learning experience, and it's a whole lot of fun. So circle March 29th through 30th, 2024 onto your calendars and join us for a 24-hour empowerment, education, and cyber gaming fun. Let's make this year's Wicked 6 the best one yet.
Going back to you, Scott, just a little bit, obviously was stalking you before I got you on the podcast, but I wanted to know, you have a degree in history and then you have international relations and European studies degree. How did you get to technology? That's a huge leap. So I would like you to make that leap here.
Thanks for that question. I like to tell people that I'm a perfect example that you don't have to be smart to be in cybersecurity, right? Even a history major like me can do it. I got a master's degree in European studies and international relations. I had a good year traveling around Europe while I got that master's degree. Moved down to DC, wanted to work for the Center for Foreign Relations Committee, right? And I didn't know anybody. You know, I quickly learned that people like me with no contacts, or we're a dime a dozen down here, right? No contacts, no experience. So I started temping, and I ended up, the short version of it is I ended up temping at the U.S. Chamber of Commerce in 1999, 2000, running that time frame. And they were just starting to build a program to bring industry and government together to secure the critical infrastructure. PDD 63, I think, was just issued. The Marsh Commission report. Anyway, the concept was there's a national security concern to secure the critical infrastructure, but these are owned and operated by industry. So how do we get industry and government to work together? And I did a temp assignment for that for the person at the chamber, Stephen Jordan, who was leading that program. Stephen kept me on, and he made me a full-time employee. And then 5 years later, 2005, I was, after standing up some of these organizations and working to build, standing up sector coordinating councils and ISACs and stuff. In 2005, I was asked if I wanted to join the IT ISAC to be its first executive director. And wow. I've been there ever since. So I was kind of lucky, right? I got good timing, right? My timing was good. But I also worked hard and proved my worth to team at the chamber there that kept me on.
And then you still sort of fulfilled a dream of being able to work in D.C. I mean, that.
Yes. It was actually, yeah, the chamber was right across the street from the White House. My apartment was on Capitol Hill. So I was able to turn it into a good couple of years. But it was, you got to get a start, right? And I was lucky where I got my start. The chamber was a great organization. It does a lot of interesting work, and there's a lot of smart people there. It was a great place for me to get started. And it got me in the field, too, where I'm not doing what I did. I didn't have to be technically proficient, but over the last 23 years, I already call myself technically proficient, right? I mean, my mom thinks I'm a cyber guy, but there's the people who I work with that, I can't hold a candle to them. But I know enough, right? I know how the technology works. I know enough about the threat actors and how they exploit the technology that I make great decisions. And the final part of it is I have a great team, right? Mm-hmm. My team is awesome. And I've had a couple of them who've been with me for a number of years now. And we've gotten to trust each other and enrich how they think. They know what I run information I need to make good decisions. And I know what I need, what type of guidance I need to give them to build the program that we're looking for. So it's been great. I mean, it's a long time to be doing the same thing, but it's been really challenging and really rewarding. It's meaningful work.
And I could see that for you. And I even your voice structure changed while you were talking about something you're passionate about. So don't think I didn't notice that. I'm sure that listeners caught it too. But what I like about it is it doesn't mean you don't have to be. I think being technical is kind of a trap in terms of like what your technical level is, because just because you understand terminology could make you technical. It doesn't mean you have to be able to open up a PC and fix it.
Right.
Now, would fixing the PC qualify you as technical, or knowing all the components as you fix it make you technical, or is that a different type of technical? Because to be honest, I probably couldn't tell you everything that's on a PC these days because things have changed. It's the general concept is still there, but I'm still going to call it a doohickey. Is that less technical,
Yeah.
So I think that you have this ability to have it. You are more of a technology leader and a good one. And that is rare and sometimes, and sadly enough. And the fact that you have good people surrounding you is really good. So I wouldn't call you any less technical than anybody else. I think people want to put people on different levels like that are kind of nuts. We don't have time for that. We're supposed to be securing things. We're supposed to be, focusing on the things that matter, like, I don't know, good food, healthy air and water and all the other things. And also, I wanted to go back to the point about probably some people were like, wait, what? There's water involved with PCs? Or data centers have water cooling in their floors, essentially. It's in between layers of the floors to keep the air conditioning running at a different temperature. It's really complicated in some places, and a lot of people forget about that. I can't forget about it, though, because I'm surrounded by data centers here where I live. So I know Scott echoes that as well. Yeah. It is definitely a big hub. But the nice thing about all these data centers is we have fantastic internet. It's screaming at all times, which is great. Scott, I just, as we're finishing up and wrapping up here, I wanted to have you give some advice to people who are struggling with finding community within cybersecurity and IT. And obviously this is a ploy to get them to join. But I want to talk about, because you found community where you are and you came from a non-traditional background for security and technology in general. And I kind of wanted you to share that with the audience and how you feel about that.
Yeah, thank you, Kristen. I appreciate the opportunity. Thank you for the remarks. So I think one of the things about this field is that there are so many people who want to help. Mm-hmm. There are so many nice people in this field who are out for the common good. And almost everyone in this field has really gotten a boost up from somebody else. And there are people who are really interested in returning the favor. Yeah, if you're looking to make your start in cybersecurity, you're looking for a place to call home, you're starting in a good field. The other advantage you have is that there's just a dearth of technical talent that we have. So it's still a lot of vacancies and a lot of people. So it's an in-demand area filled with people who have gotten their start from the niceties of other people. So I guess my advice would be kind of be persistent, right? If you don't have experience, you should get a certification. There are several certification organizations out there where you can do this in a pretty cost-effective manner. And if you have a contact people, ask them for advice, even informational interviews. I'm not looking for work, right? I'm not looking for you to hire me. I want to pick the brain on a topic. How can I go do this? As you mentioned, when PhD students call you, you're more than willing to give your time. I know me and others who are always willing to get talk to interested young people who are trying to make a break in the field, put together a little email, tell you what's unique about you, what you're looking to do. I want to pick your brain. Most people will accept that. Most people will pick up the phone and talk.
Definitely. And I also talk to a lot of people who are transitioning out of their previous career into cybersecurity. So, midlifers who are moving in. I think that's great because we need more diversity of thought. They are coming from industries that they never even probably thought about cybersecurity in them. And to have that extra knowledge set and legacy information on the back of it is huge. I really like talking to the college students anyways because they always are so excited and excitable about cybersecurity. And some of us who have been here for a long time just kind of go, I remember what that felt like. Thank you for reminding me, because usually we're just all very disgruntled.
It is that triumph of youthful enthusiasm, right? Which is great. But even you're talking about the people who are changing careers, I think that's another, you don't necessarily need to be technical, quote unquote, to be in a technology job. Right. There's thinking, right? If you can, it's a lot of what we do, a lot of what's in the technology is problem solving, critical thinking, logic. And if you can be a critical thinker, you can come into this field. You may not be reverse engineering malware on your first day, but there are enough policy, there are enough business issues related to the use of technology, to business issues related to cybersecurity, that you're going to be, if you can think and demonstrate that you can look at complex situations and break them down and find solutions to them, then that's a skill set you need in this path.
Yeah, being able to be a strategist and understand the industry that you're serving, not just the cybersecurity industry, but in this case, food or ag, is huge. To have that ability to be able to find solutions that fit properly, because not every solution is going to work for everybody, and it varies. Every environment's a little bit different, even though it's still the same. Even factories within companies are different per region, per state, per country. It gets really convoluted. So having the ability to be adaptive to that change is really helpful too. I would say a lot of people always ask me, like, what's your top thing you need to have to get in cybersecurity? And I say, be curious and open your mouth, say something. And I know that a lot of people are nervous about that because they don't want to be wrong. But the truth is we need people to try. Like, that's the most important part. Thanks so much for being here, Scott. Thank you for teaching us about this new group. I'm not saying new, but it is newer. And I'm glad it's so successful. And you had such great success stories within it already of collaboration and hopefully, you know, making the world just a little bit more secure within our food system and our agriculture side.
Yeah, Kristen, thank you for the opportunity. And also thank you for everything you do. You're one of the behind the scenes people who really make a real difference. People don't always see the work that you do. So I want to say thank you for what you do. And thanks for your contributions to the field. And it's been great talking with you today. It's been great getting to know you. And I look forward to collaborating with you more. So thank you.
And that wraps up another episode of Bites and Bites. A huge thank you to Scott for sharing his insight and experience with us today. Please check out the show notes for those interested in further information about IT ISAC, Food and Ag ISAC, or those wishing to connect with Scott directly. All the links and details, including Scott's upcoming moderation role at this year's RSA Conference 2024, are available there. Until next time, stay safe, stay curious, and we'll see you on the next one. Bye for now.